Our third speaker is Ethan Nadelman, who is founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan received his PhD and JD from Harvard University. Joe also received his PhD from Harvard, I should mention. Ethan also received his MS in International Relations from the London School of Economics. He is author of the book Cops Across Borders. His articles have appeared widely, ranging in such publications as Science, Foreign Affairs, National Review, American Heritage, and elsewhere. Very pleased to have Ethan Nadelman.
Thank you very much. Just since we are going on a bit, why don't we just take 30 seconds, if you want to stand up for a second, stretch, take a breath. And okay, that's enough. So I thought it would, and I'm going to talk fast because you're getting tired, and I'm from New York, and I talk fast anyway. I thought what might be useful, because in hearing Jeff's analysis and Joe's sort of talking about his evolution, just to put it a little bit in terms of my own evolution, I mean, in terms of the drug policy reform, and in sort of four stages. I mean, the first was, in my youth as a police chief, when I was not quite the police chief, but I mean 20 odd years ago doing a graduate work, and I was very curious about international drug enforcement and control, and I actually in fact did get myself a security clearance, a secret security clearance. I did go work in the State Department's Narcotics Bureau, a long time ago. And I did write the first State Department report on trying to deal with drug-related money laundering around the world, and I did go around the world interviewing drug enforcement agents, in South America, Europe, go on operations, get to know the guys who are doing this stuff. And what becomes apparent when you do that is they're not thinking about what they're doing. They're thinking about how to do what they do, but they're not thinking about what they're doing. And I even had access at that point to, at least the, secret and top secret stuff coming out of the intelligence agencies and the analyses. And there was nothing in the way of really thoughtful analysis, like which group's trafficking which, this, that, who's corrupt, but nothing in the way of looking at the consequences or the unintended consequences of the policies or the alternative policies. I mean, you just saw people kind of going along. And what I also became aware of was that on some level, there was almost a willful ignorance. I mean, a willful desire not to ask certain questions, that it was not allowed to put those questions on the table. And I can tell you something, it was bad in the late 80s. It was almost as bad throughout the 90s, and it's worse now than ever. It's worse now than ever. Just not allowed to ask research questions, not because even to ask the question is to suggest that that's what you want to have happen, right? So there's a total absence of critical analysis on the part of Congress, the part of the administration, almost anybody else. That was my first awareness. The second one was coming out of that, and basically the stuff that Jeff's been talking about in the late 80s, starting to write and think about all the consequences of prohibition and realizing the extent to which most of what we identify as part and parcel of the drug problem are in fact the results of drug prohibition, the analogy to alcohol prohibition, right? And seeing in fact the extent to which those in power, those promoting the drug war, wanted to keep a confusion going. They did not want people, and they do not want people distinguishing between the negative consequences of drug use and the negative consequences of prohibition. They want the mishmash. They want the confused thinking to the extent that their own thinking is not confused, because there are some people whose thinking is not confused who are promoting this policy. And so what was pivotally important, that's what Jeff does so beautifully in this book here, is really to distinguish what are the negative consequences of prohibition, because it's only through that awareness of it, that same awareness that seized people in the late 1920s and early 1930s and caused them to repeal the 18th Amendment and end the prohibition of alcohol, understanding that Al Capone was not about booze, it was about prohibition. Understand the violence and corruption were not about booze, they were about the prohibition. Understand that even the overdose fatalities and people dying of bad wood alcohol and all this sort of stuff was about prohibition. Well, that led to a sort of third phase, and this one I'll talk about a little more. Because the question does arise, and it kept arising, what is the optimal drug policy? What is the optimal model? I mean, there are some people who are, you know, diehard libertarian, and for them it's not a consequentialist issue. It's a matter of rights. And you have a right to use, a right of your body, a right to buy, sell, right to property. Damn the consequences. We believe legalization is the answer. Right? But there was another perspective, and that perspective was emerging under the rubric of the term harm reduction. It was the one that said the optimal drug policy is the policy which most successfully reduces two things. Reduces, on the one hand, the negative consequences of drug use, right? Overdoses, addiction, disease, cirrhosis, I mean, all these sorts of things. And on the other hand, reduces the negative consequences of prohibition, the crime, the violence, the corruption, all these other sorts of things. And that the optimal drug policy is the one which most successfully achieves that dual objective of reducing drug abuse and reducing the harms of drug prohibition. And the question was, okay, what is that optimal policy? What does it look like? Right? Now, there are some who are firmly convinced from a libertarian perspective who say the optimal policy in terms of reducing drug abuse and reducing the harms of prohibition is the full legalization model. Go there. And that's to some extent a suggestion of Jeff's study. Right? And in fact, that may well be the right answer. But I was curious about what happens when you bring a cross-section of people together. And so I was teaching at Princeton at that time, and I pulled together a group of 18 scholars from about a dozen disciplines, and we called it the Princeton Working Group on the Future of Drug Use and Alternatives to Drug Prohibition. And they were from, Andy Weil, who's a natural medicine guy, Lester Grinspoon and Sasha Shulgin, Marsha Rosenbaum, who's sitting here right now, John Morgan and Lynn Zimmer, who subsequently wrote the book Marijuana Myths, Marijuana Facts, Harry Levine, who authored the essay that David just mentioned, Robin Room, who used to run the Alcohol Research Group, Ken Warner, a distinguished public health economist at Michigan, Sylvia Law, distinguished NYU law professor, a remarkable group of people. None of them ideologically sort of libertarian in the kind of Milton Friedman sense. All of them highly critical of the drug war. And our challenge was to design the optimal drug policy. And we had these spectacular sessions. This was in the early 1990s. And we finally got, and the way I kind of sort of put it out to people is, let's imagine this. I said, let's imagine, take two extremes. At one extreme, imagine that we have the current situation of drug prohibition. And ask yourself, how can we modify and decriminalize and public healthicize prohibition as much as possible, right, to reduce its negative consequences without inviting substantial increases in drug use? So stretching from the prohibition model through what's called harm reduction, through decriminalization and needles and methadone programs and heroin maintenance and all of these sorts of things that the Europeans were starting to do. And on the other hand, let's imagine a really total free market in drugs, right? Which for most people conjures up a nightmare scenario of rampant drug addiction and drug abuse and Sodom and Gomorrah and all that sort of stuff, and which, it's hard to argue. You can't prove it. I mean, Jeff makes a persuasive case that it's not going to go there, and my gut feeling is it's not going to go there. But you could, and how do you then put on there increased taxation, increased restrictions, regulations? Think about cigarettes, for example. We're trying to reduce cigarette addiction and the cancers and all that stuff. What sorts of, additional controls could you put on to try to reduce the harms of drugs without inviting the harms of prohibition? And to try to take these two models and sort of stretch them together and see if we can sort of get right in the middle and figure out that optimal policy in the end. And so we got to the third session of these things, these amazing weekend meetings, and we got to basically the $64,000 question of the drug legalization debate, which is, do you believe that there should be any government-sanctioned gatekeeper, a cop, a doctor, a pharmacist, whatever, between the producer-distributor of these drugs and the consumer? In other words, should it be over-the-counter, or should there be something resembling a prescription thing or a prohibition or whatever, right? And so, we voted. We took a vote of the 18 of us. Do you believe that there should be some government-sanctioned gatekeeper, which would mean not really full legalization, or not? And the group split right down the middle. And we spent the entire day hassling this out and thinking it through and, you know, debating it, and we voted again at the end of the day, and the group split right down the middle again. But people had switched sides. And what I came to realize is that for the large majority of people I know who don't really aren't sort of viscerally fully libertarian, but who sort of empathize with legalization, they're essentially legalizers 3 days a week or four, and not legalizers the other days. Or they're legalizers at that moment, but not at that moment. And there's that what happened, and essentially that what distinguished that group, and also what distinguishes that group as a whole from many of the prohibitionists, was ultimately not susceptible to the type of analysis that Jeff was offering. Because what it really boiled down to, what the divide was really about, was inherently visceral. It was about a visceral, emotional feeling about the vulnerability of human beings in our society or in modern society around the world to the greater existence of powerful and not so powerful psychoactive substances. And so that deep down, right, Jeff believes, based upon analysis, but also I think on some visceral level, I would suspect, right, that people are not that vulnerable, and we have lots of evidence to show that. And deep down, I'm just a step away from where he is. I'm a few more doubts, but there, you know? But deep down, there are other people, including people of goodwill, who just feel, maybe it's because they have addiction running in the family, because they've seen the devastating consequences of alcoholism, of other drug addiction, or maybe because they just feel most people are rotten, and if you give them a chance to fuck themselves up, that's what they're going to do, you know? I mean, but, you know, but that, and they, you know, and so, you know, you get, for example, the former drug czar, Bob DuPont, under Nixon, he, you know, if you legalize cocaine, you're going to have 50 million junkies, and you say, Bob, where'd you get that number from? You know, well, but you know, cocaine, and look at the rats and the monkeys, you know, well, actually, Bob, you know, those rat and monkey studies, yeah, if you put a monkey behind bars and you give him cocaine, he's going to mess himself up. But you know, if you give those same monkeys in the wild cocaine, they go, okay, I walk away from it after a while. I mean, it's about context and about setting and stuff, right? So, you know, we got, so finally I said, okay, is there a model here that can compromise this thing? Is there some model that stretches these things together, right? And that comes up with something that can both kind of gut prohibition on the one hand, but also respect the concerns and desires of public health people, you know, who are not at all libertarian, right? They're about trying to control and reduce harms and reduce health harms, right? And the model that we came up with out of this whole thing, I would best describe it, and it's a model with all the flaws on it, right? A model. But we called it the mail order model, okay? And this was the idea. Right? Because what people are really afraid about legalization, realistically and otherwise, is that what's going to happen is that, you know, I mean, you want to have people marketing methamphetamine and cocaine and selling like cigarettes and booze and, you know, sexy girls and the whole, I mean, what do you want to, you know, that there's a fear, and it might be a valid fear, right? And so the idea was, imagine if you will, right? First, that everybody in America, at least adults, has assume a right to possess and to consume at least a small amount of the substance for your own use. Let's regard that as a human or slash constitutional right, that you have a right. And that from that right grows what you might call a second right, a right of access, a right to obtain that substance, anything, whatever it might be, from a legitimate source that would be civilly liable for misproducing or misrepresenting its product. Now, you don't want to market all over the place from any people's perspective, so then imagine you have just one source in America, let's say like a vitamin house in Iowa, right? And that anybody in America, right, could dial up, call up, fax up, or we're doing email back then, but email, right? And give your credit card number, and maybe you'd have to build in some proof of age ID system or something like that. And you could have within 24 hours, or by mail if you prefer, you know, sent to you, wherever you are in the country, up to certain amount of methamphetamine, marijuana, mushrooms, LSD, whatever it might be, right? And that where you live, states and localities could do what they wanted. If New York wanted to allow marijuana to be sold in tobacco stores, that's fine. If Mississippi wanted to be totally dry, no advertising, no nothing, that's fine. But wherever you were, if you're in New York or down in Mississippi on business, you would still have the right to obtain that package overnight delivery to you that you could consume right there in privacy, and you would be legal. And it seemed to me that maybe that was a system which effectively gutted prohibition. I mean, you still have black markets for people who wanted to get in less than 24 hours. You might have black markets for kids, right? I mean, you would have, you know, and in fact, you'd probably have even little groups. But there would be no way for organized crime in this market to grow vast because anybody could get it from a licensed source within 24 hours. On the other hand, all of the fears of the big promotion of drugs and the widespread availability and the widespread acceptability and all that sort of stuff, well, that would be kind of nullified in a way because, you know, there's only this vitamin house type thing. You know, and in fact, if you look even at some of the models for that, I mean, here are like elderly people who could get all, you know, all sorts of prescription drugs. I mean, now anybody can get drugs on the internet, but before, you know, elderly people could get it that way. And there's other models. So we came up with that model, and I published a paper in the journal Daedalus about in the early 1990s, and the piece was called "Thinking Seriously About Alternatives to Drug Prohibition." Right? Those of you who want to see it, go to our website drugpolicy.org, and you'll find that paper. And we published that paper, and I have to tell you, there was no market for it. Nobody was interested. You know, Charlie Rangel kept saying, hey, let me know your model, you know, who's going to do it, who's going to sell it, who's going to this it and that at it, you know? And, okay, we gave him answers. Snore. He didn't care. You know why? Because 90% of Americans weren't going for legalization, and 80% weren't going for legalization of marijuana. And Peter wasn't really, it was that the questions on his part were farcical. They weren't real. Which led me to a conclusion, which was maybe the next thing to do in life would be to try to create the market for that argument, right? Let's build a movement. Let's build a political movement to try to end the war on drugs and turn people's life around. And basically, that's what, you know, I've been trying to do with a bunch of my colleagues. I have some of them right here. You know, it's trying to end the war on drugs, trying to change consciousness, you know? And I only got probably a few more minutes, so I mean, just to whip it up, what I'll say is, in terms of my own evolution, whereas the first phase was understanding how the drug enforcers did what they did, and the second phase was sorting out what were the consequences of drug prohibition as opposed to the consequences of drugs, and the third phase was trying to figure out ideally what would be the optimal model, the fourth phase, which is now going on basically 10 years, is how do we transform public opinion and ultimately public policy and the laws, right? And I think what we've done, I mean, what I and my colleagues have done is to try to build a powerful national advocacy organization, you know, the Drug Policy Alliance. I mean, you know, we got 50 of us now working around the country. We've got 20 people in California, 25 in New York, a few others in a few other states, you know. And you know, we've got 20,000 members. If you're not a member yet, please join. Go to drugpolicy.org and join and support. But, I mean, basically the idea is this. It is to keep in mind the vision of where we want to head. The vision of basically gutting drug prohibition, of ending drug prohibition as we know it. That harm reduction vision of the optimal policy being to reduce the harms of drugs and the harms of prohibition. And based upon a core fundamental notion that nobody should be punished in any way simply for what they put in their body. That's a core notion. We regard it as a core human rights notion, and we also regard it as fundamental to good public policy in this area. And that means keeping that vision always in mind, yet spending the vast majority of our time and our effort on the incremental, nitty-gritty political work of working and changing the way people think and act. And that's what we've been doing. You know, in the mid-90s, we realized that a majority of Americans were beginning to say medical marijuana should be legal. Right, the first issue where a majority of the public were peeling off, right? And there was a local initiative that was getting going here, and we got in, we jumped in, we supported it. It was Prop 215 in California, and it opened up a whole wonderful set of things. And then we took those initiatives to other states in Alaska and Oregon and Washington and Colorado and Nevada, Maine and D.C. We won those things. And then going through the state legislatures and winning that way and trying to legitimize and legalize the distribution of marijuana for medical purposes. Then we saw the asset forfeiture laws, that when you told ordinary Americans, you know, that they could lose their property without having to be convicted of a criminal offense, and that the cops or the prosecutors who seize it got to keep it for their own departments, right? I mean, sort of this exact stuff that, you know, the founders of this country was recoiled against, right? Well, we did ballot initiatives on that in Oregon and Utah, won both of those 2-1. And then we saw that people were saying, you know, we're locking up too many people. If people have a drug problem, let's provide treatment instead of incarceration. And we did first this Prop 200 in Arizona in 96, and then Prop 36 in California in 2000. Which you guys should be proud, because that is the single most significant piece of sentencing reform legislation in this country since the repeal of alcohol prohibition. Tens of thousands of people who would otherwise be behind bars are not behind bars because of the law that you guys voted for 61% of the vote in the year 2000. Not that the people who oppose it aren't trying to warp it and bring it back to what it was, but it was understanding where the public was at and meeting them where they were at while always keeping the vision of where we're going. Now, where is it going and how do we get to that next stage? Very quickly, here's what I think. I mean, I think, first of all, I think that the marijuana reform movement has a lot to learn and resembles a lot the gay rights movement. You know, it's all about a transformation. It's not just the policy arguments. It's not just the stuff in the courts. It's also understanding. It's about people, you know, 100 million Americans have smoked pot. Right? I mean, we can't even find a presidential candidate who will deny use it anymore, right? I mean, you know, it's out there. I mean, you know, half of all Americans at the age of 18 or 55, you know, will admit to smoking pot, and even more of them actually did it and won't admit it, you know, or they can't remember. But I mean, it's, you know, I mean, that there's an evolution. It's people coming out and change in the same way, and it's what happens in the TVs and the sitcoms and the movies, you know, and we already see that. And also, by the way, it's also being attentive to language. If you ask the ordinary American, you want to legalize marijuana? 25% say yes. If you say, how about we make marijuana legal? In other words, don't use the Z in legalize. Just say, make it legal. All of a sudden, it jumps to 30%. And then you say, well, how about a policy that makes it like alcohol? Tax it, control it, regulate it, and educate kids from getting in trouble with it. 41% we got last year. Higher than that in California and close to 50% in Nevada and Alaska, right? Understanding the importance of the language on this sort of thing. And also understanding that for many people, their greatest fear about legalization is that they think that means loss of control, out of control. And then when you try to point out, well, actually, prohibition represents the abdication of control, they don't quite get that part. There's a fear that legalization means condoning or out of controlness, right? So understand the public wants control. In this area, control, regulation, syntax are good, 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 even for conservatives and even for many people who are quite libertarian in their thinking on this stuff. Secondly, medical marijuana. Right, you guys, Oaksterdam, right? I mean, you know, it's a medical marijuana. I think that medical marijuana, if in fact we can go to the next steps where localities and states begin to buy into the regulation and control of this the same way they are in Canada and some other countries now, where the state becomes a participant in it. I mean, they're already doing patient IDs, but go to the next level on distribution. So it's controlled, right? That becomes a model. And then the question is, what's medical, right? I mean, you know, marijuana helps a lot of people in a lot of different ways. So does alcohol. All of a sudden, we now find out that, you know, two drinks a day is like almost better than jogging for your cardiovascular stuff, you know? I mean, literally. I mean, that was a front page story. Yes, quite. I'm telling you, read that New York Times front page story based upon dozens and dozens of scientific studies. You know, and, you know, what's Viagra? Right? Okay, it's medicine. Yeah, right. I mean, but, you know, I mean, it's the whole idea of prescribing, you know, and the same thing with marijuana. I mean, people use it like the drink at the end of the day. They use it for this, they for that. I mean, you know, it's an antidepressant for some people. It's a Viagra for some people. It's a this, it's a that. I mean, and so I think the medical marijuana may provide that controlled regulatory model that can ultimately be expanded to allow for the distribution for the recreational user as well. Now, that's marijuana. And since half the drug arrests in this country are about marijuana, and probably about a quarter of all the people behind bars and drug charges of marijuana, you know, we're talking a lot. We're talking $10, $20 billion a year on marijuana enforcement, and we're also talking about potential tax revenue from this stuff. Now, on the other side, with the other drugs, I mean, there we're talking about is what's called harm reduction. You know, 90% of Americans aren't going for legalization. The question is, how do you try to pull back the criminal justice piece? And that's a few pieces there. One, it means challenging over and over and over the notion that people who sell drugs to other adults are morally the equivalent of rapists and murderers and other violent criminals. That's bull, right? But as far as I'm concerned, people who sell heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine to other adults and sell good quality heroin and cocaine and methamphetamine are no different than people selling good quality booze and cigarettes and other things that can be highly dangerous to many consumers but not most.
That's where they are morally. And we have to bring those penalties down, 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 so that we begin to look at them in a whole nother way. And then, for the person who's a drug addict, you know, that's what alternatives are. That's about providing people treatment. Treatment not as kind of, you know, this kind of lock them, you know, encounter group, blah. I mean, it helps some people. But I mean, treatment defined as whatever helps people get their lives together, even if they're still using drugs. And here is the thing where we have to be most careful. And this is what's going on with Prop 36 right now. You know, it's going to have to be renewed for the funding pretty soon in California, a couple of years. The question is, when we divert people into quote-unquote treatment, are we really getting them out of the criminal justice system, or is this just becoming a way for expanding the criminal justice system to include more and more and more people? That's what we need to be attentive to. Now, what can you do? What can you do? You live in Oakland. There's going to be a ballot initiative here. Are the sign-up forms, are they around on the table outside? Go to that guy right there, Dale Gueringer, head of this campaign. Oakland is going to have a ballot initiative, but first it needs to get the signatures. Okay, my organization is investing in this, so are others. And it basically says two things. It says that the people of Oakland believe that marijuana should be made legal, and that when the state does it, we're there. And it says, secondly, since Oakland can't do that by itself until the state does it, we're going to make marijuana enforcement the lowest priority. Right? I mean, that I spent this morning, actually, 45 minutes with your mayor this morning. I said, look, at least don't oppose it, you know? He said, marijuana already is the lowest priority. He said, good, you got nothing to be against then, you know? So, I mean, you know, maybe that will happen. But support that initiative. Be attentive to what's going on in Sacramento. We have a Sacramento office that has become the office for sensible drug policy. And finally, join the Drug Policy Alliance. Decide that this is going to be a priority issue for you. You know, make this issue number one, two, or three. Get involved. Do it. Thanks.